Thanks for tuning in for the November 30th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. This week's feature interviews with Dr. Christopher Klein and focuses on the incidence and prevalence of small fiber neuropathy and how it has an effect on longitudinal impairment and disability. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Cheryl Carcel will discuss whether the representation of women in stroke clinical trials reflects the burden of disease that they experience in the population.
Hey, this is Stacey Clarney, and today I'm speaking with Christopher Klein. Chris is a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and the author of the paper, Small Fiber Neuropathy, Incidence, Prevalence, Longitudinal Impairments, and Disability. Chris, thanks for joining us today on the podcast to talk to us all about small fiber neuropathy.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. So first, I want to talk about the details of your paper in a few minutes, but I want to get a sense of your methods for diagnosing small fiber neuropathy. This comes up for me in clinic a lot, and it's a challenge. What things does a patient tell you that immediately makes you think, oh, this could be a small fiber neuropathy?
Thank you. I think probably pain is the number one feature, and the quality of the pain and teasing that out is essential in considering the differential, including not only time of day, activity provocation. And then in terms of quality, is it burning, stinging, tingling, jabbing, aching? Because there are so many things that, of course, can give you pain. And nociceptive small fibers for many non-neurologic problems go along. So the nerve is just the messenger. It's really not the cause. And that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges in small fiber neuropathy, trying to figure out, is the primary problem in the nerve? Or is the nerve just doing its job and alerting the patient about some other cause?
Okay, that's helpful. And with that sort of clinical history, to put it on the differential, the next step is obviously figure out what's causing it. So what are the lab tests you would say you order first pass on everyone with that sort of concern?
The first pass should include the glucose. We usually do a monoclonal for possibility of early amyloid and small fiber involvement there. We'll usually do an autoimmune cascade looking for rheumatologic problems like lupus, Sjogren's, rheumatoid factor, and those would be sort of the basics. The more exotics that we tend to do more of here at the Mayo, because we kind of get a one shot for many patients coming from far away, include things related to family history like TTR amyloid or familial amyloidosis, forms of Fabry's disease, types of autoimmune small fiber processes. And I think those are also sometimes more common than even the more exotics, which are some rare genetic forms. So mutations in SCN9A that cause erythromelalgia. Mutations in the new gene RFC1 that associates more commonly with large fiber and small fiber involvements. But I think before I order any of these tests, I really work hard to try and get a good neurologic exam and localize whether first I think it truly is a neurologic process or if it's something else.
Yeah, it always comes back to the exam. That's helpful and a great reminder. I always forget about Fabry's as a non-neuromuscular doc, so it's a great reminder for me. I tend not to get a biopsy to prove the diagnosis when I'm convinced of it clinically because it doesn't usually help me determine the etiology or change my symptomatic management. But again, I'm not a neuromuscular doc. So do you agree or disagree with that approach?
So I think overall, that's a perfectly acceptable approach. And, you know, at the Mayo, we have the advantage of a lot of very sophisticated and accurate autonomic testing that's non-biopsy driven. So, you know, a QSART, quantitative pseudomotor response test, can look at the sweating ability, which is part and partial part of the same group of fibers, or a thermoregulatory sweat test that can look not only at one spot, but the entire body for small fiber dysfunction. So frequently that's how we would do it. Now there are exceptions. So sometimes patients come and they're on strong pain medicines that include anticholinergic effect. So you can get a lot of false positives with those tests. if they're on the wrong medications. So if we really need to know, then that would be the time we might be more likely to go to getting punch biopsy.
That's a great point. Now, let me ask you something too, because a lot of our listeners also don't have access to the thermoregulatory sweat test or the QSART. It's more available, but still not to everyone. Does that change usually how you're going to treat, or is it more of a confirmatory test?
Well, I think, and one of the big points of our paper is when we try to define who had small fiber neuropathy, we used search-based tools to look for that term. And what we found is almost half of the patients who were originally suspected of having small fiber neuropathy, in fact, they ended up having something else, whether it was fibromyalgia, whether it was some sort of tendonitis, some type of fasciitis, some type of myofascial pain disorder. And the treatment recommendations might be quite different. And again, going back to the history and exam, for many of those disorders, you get sort of provocative worsening. So a squeezing of the arch of the foot, you know, leads to a very specific reproducing pain. Versus most of the idiopathic or even the causal small fibers, the pain is just there. And deep palpation, walking on it tends not to make it any worse. So one of the big clues when I'm walking down the hall to see my patient, if I see a wheelchair in the hall, I'm much more likely to think, and they tell me that they can't stay on their feet because it hurts so bad, that this is going to be a rheumatologic process. And if a large number, almost a half of our non-neurologics had one of those things I mentioned, or a very specific diagnosis, gout, and they didn't have the classic bright red toe, they had more of a psoriatic deposition of uric acid crystals. And so that those are all kind of clues that you can get in the history and exam, and, you know, informing you about how far to go.
Wow, that's great. And so in those cases, you're saying when it was more difficult than doing the specific test, the QSART, the thermoregulatory sweat test, and seeing a negative result on those helped you to go further. Am I understanding that right?
Exactly. So, and in those patients, you know, again, I have a kind of a one-time chance for many of them when they're out of state. I might even order a test like uric acid, which is not that sensitive. And then, or many radiology departments now have available to them a test called dual CT, and it actually can look at the uric acid deposition in and around the areas that have pain. And that's a very informative test for us.
Wow, yeah, I've never ordered that myself. That's good to know. So back to your paper again. So what did you find out in your cohort about how common small fiber neuropathy was?
So we, you know, when we calculated the incidence, in contrast to earlier studies, we included all ages. So the prior study from the Netherlands suggested it was about 13 in 100,000, but they only looked at a single year and they only included adults. So when we look at the entire 20-year cohort and we looked at all ages, the incidence was only about 1.3 per 100,000. So it's actually about as common or a little less common than CIDP. And remember, our cohort only included those that had isolated small fiber neuropathy at presentation. Of course, many of them went on to develop large fiber involvements. And I suspect that most generalized neuropathy patients who have pain clearly have a small fiber component, but we wanted to be very pure about this and just included those people who had truly isolated small fiber neuropathy at onset. But a third of them within a five-year period would go on to develop large fiber involvements.
So it is really important to keep an eye on these patients as well. And I guess we should specify too, this was the Olmsted County cohort, right?
Exactly. So we started off just with Olmsted County, but when the numbers were so low, we expanded it to a 7-county region. And the reason these counties are important is that they really obtain 95% of all their health care at the Mayo.
So for those patients, how disabling is small fiber neuropathy?
So, you know, if you look at their self-assessments of disability, virtually none of them said that they were disabled with a specific question. But if you look at surrogate measures of disability, so difficulty climbing stairs, difficulty walking, those kind of things, they did have a number of positives. But overall, compared to our earlier cohort of generalized neuropathy patients, they're far less disabled. And in fact, their average modified Rankin score was 1 compared to their age and sex match controls in the same population, which was 0. So their disabilities are fairly mild. Neurologic disabilities are fairly mild. And that includes looking at them over a long period of time, that most of them, the ones of idiopathic etiology, they did not accrue new major disabilities on the whole. So 70% of the population, you know, were found to have small fiber neuropathy, really never developed a significant neuropathy impairment score. But of course, pain is a disabling feature, and many of them had insomnia. Many of them were on analgesics, including narcotics. And so in terms of psychic burden, it's very large, but most of them were able to, you know, carry out their ADLs, go to work, you know, and have meaningful lives.
So that's really informative from a couple aspects. If I am talking to a patient and I am really getting a sense that they're disabled, that they're not able to do those activities of daily living, I should perhaps in the back of my mind be saying, is there something else going on here? And then on the flip side, it does help me to focus in maybe on which questions to ask, you know, about, like you said, pain and insomnia, and bring those to the forefront when I'm doing symptom management.
Exactly. If they are moving forward at any significant measurable rate, they're much more likely to have one of the causal etiologies, either new diabetes, which is typically out of control, meaning A1C is over 7%, one of the rare forms like the amyloid that I mentioned, either TTR or primary amyloid, or even one of the autoimmune processes. So I usually on the phone can triage and say, well, can you still walk on your heels and toes? And if the answer is yes, and you know, you're not developing rapid new symptoms in your hands or ascending quickly, you know, usually it's a pain management issue. But for those where they give you that history, then they really need to have a second look and make sure that they haven't evolved into something else.
Right. So definitely bring that subset back in for a visit sooner is what I'm taking home. So what can we do to best help these small fiber neuropathy patients? Do you have any hints for us what analgesics tend to help the best in your hands? Any advice?
So, you know, it's a retrospective trial. And I think probably there are better prospective trials that could answer this question, which a lot of our docs have been informed on. So most of our patients were on gabapentin. And then we tried hard if they were on narcotics to try and maximize the non-narcotic medicines, the non-addictive medicines based on side effect. And then we do talk about foot care, but probably one of the most important messages from our paper is the importance of having them be seen back in internal medicine clinics where blood sugars can be monitored. And the most striking thing, I think, and probably the most important finding of the study is that whether it was the idiopathics or the causals, that they had a much higher rate of cardiovascular disease. And this has been hinted at in earlier work with metabolic syndrome. And that was another finding, is that they tended to have higher BMIs and they had higher triglycerides. Is that there's something kind of sinister about this phenotype in terms of risks for neuropathy and diabetics of the same glucose control, but also what we're finding here is their risk for cardiovascular disease. And if you look at from the time of the diagnosis of their small fiber neuropathy and mortality, they have significant mortality compared to the matched age and sex controls. And so most of their mortality, half of the patients who did die, died from cardiovascular complications. And in the entire cohort, 50% had a heart attack.
And this is with and without diabetes?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, of course, diabetes contributed to more of those patients, but clearly others also had these complications.
That's a great point. You know, I think so often we come in, we do the evaluation, I check the hemoglobin A1C, but I don't necessarily in my note back to the referring primary care physician say, by the way, let's really stay on top of this. Let's continue to check and maybe have a lower threshold to keep an eye on cardiovascular risk factors in this population.
Right. So one of the things we did do is we compared this cohort to our earlier neurology published paper on generalized neuropathy for a number of Charlson comorbidities. And among the general neuropathy cohort, the risk for cardiovascular disease was far less than in patients with small fiber neuropathy. And the odds ratio, I think, was around 2 to 3 over generalized neuropathy patients. So I think this is a really important, you know, wedge in understanding and may lead to additional research into why. But from the standpoint of practical patient caring doctors, we really should be getting these patients back to see their primary care doctors and maybe getting them to an earlier Bruce protocol or to even more aggressive cardiovascular evaluation.
Such an important point, but certainly this comes up for all neurologists when we're caring for all specialties. So Chris's paper again, it's in the journal Neurology titled Small Fiber Neuropathy, Incidence, Prevalence, Longitudinal Impairments, and Disability. Thank you again, Chris, for sharing all this expertise with us.
My pleasure.
This is Amy Guzik at Wake Forest School of Medicine. I'm here with the Neurology Podcast, and today I'm speaking with Cheryl Carcel, neurologist and senior research fellow at the George Institute, where she leads the study of sex differences of stroke in the Global Women's Health Program. We're talking about her recent paper from the November 2nd issue of Neurology, titled Representation of Women in Stroke Clinical Trials, a review of 281 trials involving more than 500,000 participants. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's such a great pleasure to be on the Neurology Podcast. I listen to this podcast all the time, and to be able to present my work here is such an honor.
Well, we're excited to have you. There's an increasing focus on sex disparities in disease prevalence and severity and in trial representation. Can you tell us why this is important in stroke, and how did you decide to tackle this question?
That's a great question. So now we know that there are sex differences in stroke from epidemiology to risk factors and management. But I guess the next step is how can we improve upon these differences, which can often be inequities. One of the ways we thought would help would be to first have adequate representation of women and men in clinical trials and to actually report these findings by sex, particularly in drug and device trials. And again, this is important because as clinicians, we want to use medications and devices on the same population that it's actually been tested on. Earlier, I mentioned that we need to have adequate, but I didn't say equal representation of the sexes in clinical trials, even though 50% of the global population are women. And I say that because the prevalence of stroke in women in the different population around the world is not 50%. So in our study, what we looked at is the percentage of women participating in a trial and compared it with the prevalence of stroke in the population. And this is called the participation to prevalence ratio, or PPR. And a result of less than one indicates that there are less women in clinical trials. That is reflective of the disease population, and that's a problem.
And what did you find with that methodology?
So in this study, we used the clinicaltrials.gov database, which many of you will be familiar with, and this is the world's largest clinical trial registry, to find stroke trials with more than 100 participants. And we also used the Global Burden of Disease database for prevalence of stroke in the community in women per country. And overall, we looked at over 280 stroke trials. And this was conducted between 1990 and 2020, but most of the trials were actually registered from 2000 when clinicaltrials.gov started. And the total number of participants, as you mentioned earlier in our title, was over 500,000, of whom 37% were women. The participation of women varied across individual trials from 3% to 78% and a mean of 40%. And based on the GBD data, the mean prevalence of stroke in women across countries was 48%. And what does this all mean? So the when you put it together, the prevalence to participation ratio of overall all these studies was less than one. This indicated that they enrolled less women than the expected proportion of stroke in the background population.
Were there certain types of trials where the disparity was more striking?
Absolutely. So we looked at different types of trials. We looked at ischemic stroke trials, intracerebral hemorrhage trials, and trials that enrolled both. We looked at trials for prevention, acute stroke trials, rehab trials, non-acute. Also looked at it by age, below 70 and above 70. And what we found was the disparity was greatest in ICH trials. Trials that had a mean age of participants of less than 70, non-acute intervention trials, and this means enrollment after 24 hours of symptom onset, and rehabilitation trials.
Recently, there's been more awareness of the need for representation in many aspects of medicine. Did you see any improvement over the years in the trials that you looked at?
These results actually surprised us. And from what we saw, there has been no change from 2000 to 2020 in the representation of women in stroke trials relative to the burden of disease in the population. And over this 20 to 30 year period, you know, several countries and regions, including the US, Canada, and Europe, have adopted policies that emphasize the importance of inclusion of women in clinical trials. And these findings suggest that these efforts have not been clearly translated into action.
Wow, so it sounds like there's still more work to be done despite the increased awareness over the recent years. I'm sure it's difficult to tease out the reasons for underrepresentation across such a wide body of trials, but do you have any thoughts about common issues that could lead to this disparity, specifically in stroke?
You're right. A lot of this work has been done in cardiovascular disease, but not stroke. And there could be similarities, but then, you know, stroke patients are such a unique population in what they experience after they've had stroke. And we think that on one hand, the cause of underrepresentation of women in stroke trials could be trial design specific factors, where certain design factors, for example, maximum age as an exclusion criteria, could impact enrollment of women. But on the other hand, some studies have shown that it could be more patient-specific factors. Either, for example, it's not a major health issue or problem for women, or that there are other priorities such as family that come first for women before their stroke. So it's really crucial that we find what the barriers and facilitators are for women to join clinical trials so that we can address them.
These findings definitely underscore the need to address the inclusion of women in stroke research. What suggestions do you have for researchers designing studies and for clinicians enrolling patients in stroke trials?
That's a really good question. And I think that's what we are trying to answer, hopefully, in a series of other studies. But in my mind, when we design trials, whether it's our eligibility criteria or the wording of the patient information and consent form, or even how we approach participants during recruitment, it's important to include people with lived experiences. So hearing the voices of women with stroke and possibly co-designing aspects of a stroke clinical trial might be one of the solutions to this problem.
That makes sense. What else do you want people to know about the importance of equitable enrollment in stroke trials?
I think it's up to all of us, clinicians, researchers, scientists, study coordinators, to ensure that there's adequate representation of the participants we will be treating. Some of the findings in our study was pretty shocking. And I mentioned earlier that enrollment of women could be as low as 3% in some studies. And you know, once you see those, even if you're still in the middle of the trial that you're recruiting, there should be active involvement of everyone to recruit more women.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to review this really important study with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to the Neurology Podcast.
Again, this is Amy Guzik. I'm speaking with Cheryl Carcel about her article, Representation of Women in Stroke Clinical Trials, a review of 281 trials involving more than 500,000 participants. You can find this in the November 2nd issue of Neurology.
Hey everyone, some exciting news to announce. In early 2022, the AAN is launching the Brain and Life Podcast. It'll be dedicated to educating the general public through interviews with celebrities, public figures, and health experts. If you've always wanted a side gig in audio or radio, here's your opportunity. The AAN is seeking two AAN members to serve as hosts for the weekly podcast. If you're interested, go to aan.com/BL podcast host. That's aan.com/BL podcast host. And make sure to apply by the December 1st deadline.
This is Jose Merino. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, and it's free for AAN members. Be sure to check out this week's journal, which includes an article comparing temporal trends in ischemic stroke rates by age, sex, and ethnicity, as well as a study examining the effects of exercise on concussion symptoms in adolescents. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.